The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition today. We've got Jim on the line remotely. He's bailed back out of the recording studio for a little bit. This time because of a minor COVID scare, I guess we might say.
Minor?
Well,
you're living in a den of petrified COVID.
That might be a little bit exaggerated. I have the COVID confined to my dark basement area.
Tell people how your family is polluting the neighborhood.
Well, I don't let them out, so the neighborhood's fine. But two of my kids actually got positive COVID tests last week. So since that moment, they've been confined to the basement, which sounds like a punishment, but it's... They get their meals served to them by handing them through the door to the stairs, kind of like a prison situation. They have no obligations. They get out of all their chores. I'm not sure they dislike it too much. They have internet and television and everything they could need down there, just not quite as much sunshine. Although we do let them out periodically for exercise in the yard, I guess. So it is a lot like prison now that I describe it. The rest of the family tested negative, so we're keeping them separated just in case. One of them's convinced that they have they got a false positive, so she went in to get retested. I don't know how that's going to work out. I don't think there's a lot of false positives, but it is. I told her it's possible.
Yeah, but even if it was a false positive,
yeah,
Chris, you've someone who has a positive positive for the last five days.
I know. That's what I told her. I said, well, if you didn't have it before, you definitely have it now that you've been down there with your brother. So yeah, that's been the excitement in the Stein household over the past week or so. But
ever since that's happened, folks, Chris has been confined in the office to staying upstairs. I affectionately call it the attic, but it's much nicer than an attic.
I call it the penthouse.
You can call it the penthouse. I call it the attic. You're the planner in the attic. But no one else can go upstairs. Chris stays up there all by his lonesome during the day. And when he comes in, he's wearing a mask and goes straight upstairs. So we're going to try to keep the office clear, but for obvious reasons, that means yours truly is not going to go into the recording studio with Chris. Irrespective of how many windows and fans that I turn on, I won't do that until Chris's family is clear and Chris tests negative 14 times in a row.
I'm 100% so far.
Well, you're one for one. You got 13 more tests to go.
Right.
So for the time being, we're going to go back to recording via the phone. So our sound is okay, but not as good as it could be. But hopefully it'll work. I'm sitting at home. I did not go into the office today. I was in the office yesterday, but I have to actually do a continuing education course this afternoon for 4 hours online, and thought I would do that at home rather than the office.
I will ask you, Jim, what microphone, what are you talking into? Because I think your mouth is a little too close to the mic, because we are getting a little bit of distortion on your end.
I'm talking into the phone.
That's whatever you did there sounds better.
Well, I moved it from in front of my mouth. Now it's like hanging down from my neck. So you want me talking this way?
That sounds better. So let's go with,
really?
Let's go with that.
Okay. That's odd. All right. So I'll talk this way. You can still hear me though.
Oh yeah.
Perfect.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, anyways, we don't want to bore our listeners with your poisonous COVID stories. But on the good news, folks, why don't you let everyone know your kids, I mean, the younger folk, they handle this well. The son
oh, yeah, they're,
has
they
it.
Don't even know
has,
they
what,
have
the
it,
sniffles?
Right? They have no real symptoms. So they're asymptomatic. The only reason they even got tested is because an acquaintance of theirs got a positive test. So that set off the chain reaction of everyone that had ever been in contact with them recently got tested and et cetera. So that's how it evolved. But there's cross fingers, no actual symptoms that we're dealing with at this point. So not nearly as bad as it could be.
But that's what makes this virus so scary, especially for older folks such as ourselves and even older in their 70s and 80s. I keep telling my mother to stay away from my niece and nephew, but she won't listen. And, you know, my niece and nephew are only in their early and mid-20s, and I keep telling her they can have it, and you won't even know it, and boom, you can catch it. So as a PSA announcement here on the show, be careful of that, folks, especially if you are a high-risk person, you're over the age of 50, or you're over the age of 50 with other conditions that put you even at higher risk. Be careful with the younger generation. Yeah. They, I think most of this increased positive tests too, Chris, are the younger generations.
Yeah, I would just, as you see them wandering around, just consider them cute little Petri dishes full of COVID and treat them as such. And you can still be loving towards them just from a distance.
Yeah, so anyways, it's scary. And Chris is dealing with it quite well. The doctors have assured him that COVID cannot pass through his walls. So it's in the basement and he's not. So just be careful if you are a grandparent or a high-risk individual hanging around younger generations. Okay, shall we get to some questions on the Q&A show?
Perfect.
Okay, we got a couple of Social Security question ones we'll lead with, and then we got a old COVID question from May that I'm glad you ignored and didn't answer right away, because the answer will have changed as of 2 weeks ago, so I want to go over that one too.
Okay.
Okay, so this first question, I think the man is a little bit wrong on some ideas of his of when to claim Social Security, but I'll let you opine in. Okay, so he wrote, I enjoy your podcasts and have learned much by listening. I have a Social Security question. Oh, by the way, he is a Coloradoan, I believe.
Oh.
So he didn't say where, but he did list that he is in Colorado. Okay, I'm working. Where did I leave off? I have a Social Security question. I am working and delaying my Social Security until age 70 and 4 months. My wife is collecting already on her record, and she waited until she reached her full retirement age to file. I am not collecting a spousal benefit. If I take my Social Security 4 months after I turn 70, and ask to have my application backdated those 4 months, can my wife switch to her spousal benefit and also ask for her benefits to be backdated those 4 months as well? That way we will get the 4 months of benefit that we missed because I have to wait. And I don't think he has to wait to 70 in 4 months. So I'm not quite sure why he feels that.
There's a couple things going on here. First of all, there is never, under current law, a benefit of delaying past 70. If you don't claim, you're not going to get anything, but you're not going to accrue any additional credits. So the credits for delaying your filing stop the month you turn 70. That doesn't mean they automatically start sending you benefits. You still have to apply. I know people, for strangely enough, that, well, I don't know them personally, but I've run into cases where they have been in their 70s and realize somebody points out you haven't claimed your Social Security yet, and they go in and claim it at that point. So it's not going to automatically start coming to you. But at 70, when he files, then apparently, and he didn't leave us any numbers or any dates of birth, so I can't comment fully on all the variables that could be at play here. But the one thing I know is true, no benefit to delaying past 70. When he claims at 70, that will unlock the door to a potential spousal benefit for his wife. So again, depending on what his wife's benefit is, if her benefit is less than half of his, not age 70 benefit, but less than half of his full retirement age benefit, if hers is less than that, then she will be owed what's called a spousal offset, which is an additional payment made so that the overall spousal benefit gets up to half of his full retirement age benefit. And I know it would go to half for her because he made the comment that she claimed her own at her full retirement age. So her own benefit is not being reduced. If she had claimed before that, her benefit would be permanently reduced, and even though she might get a spousal offset, the total amount would be still permanently reduced for the fact that she had claimed her own early. But that's not the case here. She claimed, according to him, at her full retirement age. So I don't know how much her spousal offset is, or I can't even confirm she would get one because he didn't share with us the numbers. But there is, first of all, the spousal benefit will not benefit from delayed retirement credits. There is no adjustment to that. The spousal offset is fixed at this person's, at the husband here, full retirement age benefit. So any delayed retirement credits will affect his benefit, but won't increase her spousal. Some people misinterpret that. They think that the spousal benefit is always half of what the primary person, which in this case, the higher benefit earner, the husband, half of what he's receiving. That's not the case. It's half of the full retirement age benefit. The spousal does not go up with delayed retirement credits that he is pursuing by delaying. He said till 70 plus 4 months. There's no reason to wait that extra 4 months. He may as well turn it on. Now, if he goes 70 in 4 months and realizes, oh crud, I forgot to go in and file at 70, you can go in there and file and they will backdate or make retroactive the claim up to 6 months. You cannot wait. If you were to wait to age 75, they're not going to backdate it 5 years. The most that they'll backdate it, 6 months. So they give you a little window of opportunity to realize that you missed your intended claiming month, and they will backdate it up to 6 months for you when you're as old as this. And just be aware that backdating or claiming retroactively is limited to being retroactive back to your full retirement age. So if you just missed your full retirement age claiming by, say, 2 months, they won't retroactively go back 6. They'll limit it to just back to your full retirement age. But here he's way past his full retirement age because he's talking about being 70. So he would have the opportunity for a 6-month retroactive. Now, if he went in at 70, for instance, you know, we've already established there's no reason for him to wait to 70 in 4 months. But if he were to go in at 70, he would have the opportunity to file at 66 and a half, or I'm sorry, 69 and a half, essentially, to backdate it 6 months if he wanted. But his benefit then would be based on having claimed at 69 and a half. He'd give up 6 months worth of delayed retirement credits there. So be careful if they offer you that. It'll sound attractive. They'll say, hey, would you like a lump sum payment of the last 6 months? We'll just backdate your application here. Sounds tempting, but you're giving up, you know, 4% essentially, because you get an 8% delayed retirement credit bonus on your payments for every year that you delay. If you retroactively claim 6 months before 70, you'll give up, you know, half a year's worth of delayed retirement credits in order to get that lump sum payment of those 6 months. That being said, if your circumstances have changed and at 70, you intended to claim at 70, but something happened and you need the money, a medical issue or a family issue that comes up, it is nice to have the option of claiming a 6 month retroactive benefit if you want. So I just want people to know that that is possible. But in this case, he would not want to wait to 70 plus four. As long as he's timing it out for, optimal claiming for him, if he's determined that's the way to go, he should claim, he should actually go in about 3 months before he wants to claim or put in his application. So it'll start right away the month that he turns 70. He can also have his wife file for the spousal benefit at that time. It oftentimes will turn on automatically, but not always, in my experience. So it's best to proactively tell them on her record she wants to claim the spousal in the month that you are claiming. That'll just make sure all your bases are covered. But that's probably the best way to go if you're intending to delay all the way and get the most retirement credits. Delay just till 70, not 70 plus 4.
Okay, anyways, we have another question from a New Jerseyite that also wrote to us about Social Security. Fairly straightforward question. I think he's trying to win a few brownie points because he begins with, "Hi, Jim and Chris. My name is," and he gives his real name, but we are going to, as always, protect his anonymity and call him George. And he begins, "I went to grad school in Greeley a long time ago." Greeley, folks, is in Colorado. Must have went to UNC, I would imagine, Chris?
Yep, that's most likely. Mm-hmm. Well, grad school would have to be. That's the only grad school over there, so yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. UNC, folks, is University of Northern Colorado. So I went to grad school in Greeley a long time ago. I am rapidly becoming not in my 60s anymore, but in September, I will officially become the 70-year-old me. I guess this September, he's entering a new decade of his life. That's where he's going to be turning 70 in September. I have retired since I was 56. My wife, who is 65, started collecting her Social Security when she was 62. So he has a wife about 5 years younger than him. Folks, started collecting Social Security when she was first eligible at age 62. And then he continues, "Chris, I have been collecting Social Security on her account since I turned 67. So you can see he was grandfathered under the old rules where the wife was claiming. He started claiming a spousal benefit under his wife and was delaying his benefit to age 70.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When I turn 70, I will start to collect my own benefit. I know you have beat this horse to death, but I have one question." Before I get to his question, I want to repeat that sentence, Chris.
Yeah, that how he's mocking you?
He is not mocking me. He's from New Jersey. This has got to be the fourth or fifth New Jerseyite who has written that.
It's a running joke in New Jersey now. The state of New Jersey all has a mission now to mock Jim in his use of beat a horse to death instead of beat a dead horse.
I'm telling you, Chris,
it's
a
conspiracy.
It is a Jersey, New Englandish type thing. I'm telling you.
Well, I'd be afraid.
You're telling me this guy didn't mean to write that.
Oh, I'm telling you, he did mean to write it. You're saying that's the way he talks. I'm saying he's doing it for your benefit. But if they all talk that way, I'd be nervous in New England if I were a horse. People going around beating horses to death.
Well, first of all, Jersey's not New England, but it's not far.
Well, okay.
And
back in the West, the whole region is considered New England to us. Pennsylvania is probably New England for someone from Colorado.
Well, I'm just saying that he has got to be at least the fourth or fifth person from New Jersey who has written beat the horse to death.
I got it.
Okay. Just want to point that out to you. I didn't know if you'd pick up on that.
I heard it. It grates on my nerves every time I hear it.
I know you have beat this horse to death, but I have one question. Will my wife be able to switch and collect benefits based on my full retirement age benefits if that is higher than her present benefit amount when I turn on mine at age 70? You and Chris have a great podcast and are a fantastic source of info. Thank you so much for the service you supply.
So this one is confusing for people, especially when one person has claimed early, like his wife has at 62. Again, he doesn't share the amounts here, so I can't walk you through a numeric example. But the key, he's essentially asking, when he turns on his benefit, will his wife get an increase in benefit payments? The answer is yes, if one key thing has to be true. If his full retirement age benefit is bigger than, well, let me say it a different way. If her full retirement age benefit, which she's not collecting because she claimed at 62, she claimed early. So she reduced her benefit by about 25% by claiming at 62, given her age. If her full retirement age benefit, what it would have been if she'd waited till then, is less than half of his full retirement age benefit, not his age 70 benefit, but his full retirement age benefit. If her own benefit is less than half, she is owed a bump up. Now, it won't eliminate the fact that her base benefit she's collecting has been permanently reduced by 25% for claiming early. That's a permanent effect. She can't ought to escape it. The spousal offset itself is determined by comparing those full retirement age benefits. So let me give you an example. Let's say, for instance, that his full retirement age benefit is $2,000. I'll make the numbers pretty easy to follow. His full retirement age benefit is $2,000. By delaying to 70, he would get, based on his age, his birth year, which I'm calculating is 1950, since he's turning 70 this year, his full retirement age benefit being $2,000 in my hypothetical, by rating till 70 would be $2,640. Now, I'm keeping things simple, not trying to factor in any cost of living adjustments or anything like that. But just at face value, by delaying, he increased 32%. But his full retirement age benefit was $2,000. So the potential spousal benefit for his spouse is half that, $1,000. So let's say her benefit is that she, her full retirement age benefit is $800. So ignore the fact of a minute for that, that she's actually claimed. If she were to have claimed his, at her full retirement age and he would have already claimed, they would look at that difference and say, well, under the spousal, she's owed $1,000. Her own benefit creates $800. We're going to pay her her own $800 and then pay her the difference, that $200, what they call a spousal offset, to get her up to a total of $1,000, which is half of his full retirement age benefit. That's how the math works. If she would have waited to her full retirement age. The fact that she claimed at 62, though, that potential $800 becomes $600. So she gave up 25% of it by claiming at 62 instead of claiming at 66. And she might be, depending on her age, she might be a 66 in 2 months, but let's pretend her full retirement age to keep it easy to follow is right at 66. So claiming early, she gave up 25% of her benefit, $600. So then all these years pass, he turns 70, turning on, which now opens the door for her to get a spousal benefit. She wasn't eligible for one until he claims, and he delayed all the way to 70, increasing his own benefit to that 2640 number, but his full retirement age benefit was 2000. So now when he turns on his, they look and say, oh, look, his wife now is owed a spousal benefit. How much is the spousal offset? And they're going to go back and look at the $1,000, which is half of his full retirement age benefit. They'll look at her full retirement age benefit that was $800. That $200 then, they're going to give to her. But it's going to pile on top of not her $800 on top of her $600 early claimed at 62 retirement benefit. So you can see she never gets up to the $1,000 by claiming early. In my hypothetical example here, where I just created some numbers, the most she's going to get as a spouse, $800. Her $600 having claimed early, and then the $200 spousal offset that they add to the top of it, she'll then start receiving a total of $800, while he's receiving his age 70 benefit, which in my example was $2,640. At passing, at whoever passes first, the $800 goes away, and the survivor keeps the $2,640. So just adding one extra thing in there for people that were curious, what happens when the first passes away. If he were to pass away first, she would step into his shoes and start receiving the $2,640 that he was receiving, but her benefit would go away. The smaller benefit goes away when the first of a couple passes away. So hopefully adding those numbers in kind of helped people follow along here. But and I can't confirm again in this case, kind of like the previous question, whether she will be owed a spousal or not, because he didn't supply any specific numbers. But it is possible. But remember, her base retirement benefit that she's already collecting, having been reduced by 25% for claiming early, that reduction will be maintained or retained throughout her life. And any spousal offset will be added to the top of that. Clear as mud.
Well, it's a good thing that you gave dollar amount examples. I think it made it a little bit easier to follow. What it sounds complicated, folks, but it's once you get it, once you understand it, it's not that hard to understand the spousal offset. So listen to this part of the recording a few times. Chris did walk you through it, and it'll start to sink in.
Perfect.
Okay, this question came in May, mid-May. And it was written by, I think, a son on behalf of his father. And it was a question on trying to get required minimum distributions put back into his father's IRA. And he was wondering if he was trying to be a little creative. I'm going to answer the question on the show, mostly to point out some of his creativity wouldn't work, but also to set the record straight a little bit on what constructive receipt is. Okay, so if you remember, Chris, and listeners in general, under the CARES Act, which came out, when was that, Chris, in March or April?
March, I think, yep.
I forget when, but it was somewhere in March or April. The necessity to take required minimum distributions in 2020 was removed. You don't have to do required minimum distributions. Well, part of that, which had never been done before, a few things have happened under the CARES Act that have never been done before. The two that stick out the most is the one that recently got enacted a few weeks ago in IRS ruling 2020-51, and that is people who were beneficiaries of IRAs were allowed to put their required minimum distribution back in. That was never allowed. In fact, it's specifically not allowed in the tax code.
Yeah.
And the IRS pretty much just says, forget what the law is.
Right, we're just going to ignore it.
we're going to ignore it. This is what we're going to do. Okay. So that was one thing that was done that never had been, I guess you could say, done before. This person wrote, there's a second thing that had never been allowed before. If you had delayed your 2019 RMD, this is the part I wanted to get to. If you were supposed to take your first required minimum distribution in 2019, and you decided to wait and take it in 2020, because you know you have until April 1st of the year following the year you turned to your RMD age. In fact, that rule is still in effect. So if you were going to delay your very first RMD to 2020, that delayed 2019 RMD was also eligible to not be taken.
Right.
and to be put back if you took it. That was never done before because technically that is a 2019 RMD and only 2020 RMDs were delayed. So again, another weird thing that the IRS just said, if you delayed your 2019 one, you don't have to take that either, if you were a lucky one. Now, the only people who could have delayed it, folks, were people who turned, and it's not 70 and a half because this is 2019. This would have been, that would have been 70 and a half, The Secure Act, which made it 72, took effect in 2020, correct? Or am I getting confused here? That was CARES Act.
CARES Act is 2020, yeah.
The Secure Act, was that 2019 or 2020?
That was enacted end of 2019, but it went into effect. The rule change happened January 1st of 20.
So the only people who could have delayed their RMDs were those under the old rules, turning 70 and a half in 2019. And made an election to take that RMD in 2020. And this listener's father fell right into that. He said, my father is turning 71 and has a traditional 401k and a traditional IRA in 2020. From a tax perspective, it made more sense for him to delay his 2019 first RMD until 2020, and at the time, we knew he would have to take two RMDs in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of 2020, none of us knew COVID was going to happen, and in an effort to do some additional tax planning, my father took his 2019 and 2020 required minimum distributions in January. And was sent the following checks. His 2019 RMD, a $100,000 check dated January 21st. And his 2020 RMD, a $150,000 check dated February 20th. Follow me so far on all that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because of the later IRS rulings waiving required minimum distributions, we were able to put his 2020 RMD back within the 60-day window with no issue. So let's pause there for a minute, folks, and listen to what this man is saying. The second check he got, his 2020 RMD, his dad, was for $150,000, and it was dated February 20th. He put that back when the RMDs were waived after the passage of the CARES Act. Now, at the time of this email, Chris, when he sent it, he was putting it back under the 60-day rule.
Mm-hmm.
If the after the Secure Act was passed, initially people who had taken their RMDs, if they put it back before the 60 days was up, and they hadn't taken a 60-day rollover over the previous 365 days, the IRS was allowing that RMD to go back into the IRA as if it never happened. Then they came out with some clarity and said, look, any RMDs that were taken, and this was a random date they chose, in my opinion, February 1st, any RMDs after February 1st, you had until July 15th to put back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when they passed that rule, Chris?
Boy, I remember that coming down. I would say, do you have the date?
April. I'm just asking, do you remember that rule?
I think it was, yeah, I remember that rule because we talked about it and how unfair it was to the people that just happened to be proactive and take their RMD out in January.
Right.
They were being excluded from this.
And that's what caused this email question. Was that February 1st date? So he was clear on this. When this first happened, his dad put the $150,000 back in within the 60 days because at the time, you had to have it done within 60 days of taking it. Then the IRS came out, it was a couple of weeks later, with some clarity and said, look, we're going to give you to July 15th, and we're going to let you put back any RMD taken on February 1st or later. But if you took it before February 1st, you're SOL.
Right.
That was essentially what the IRS was saying. And I had mentioned on this show that Ed Slott thought the IRS would come back and get rid of that arbitrary rule prior to February 1st. You couldn't put it back. Ed, if you remember, mm-hmm. I had just done my Ed Slott training right around that time, and I shared that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I agreed with Ed. I thought that this was patently unfair and pretty arbitrary, and that that most likely would be fixed. And they fixed it even better, but yeah. At the time this was written, that was an issue.
Right, and that fix happened in mid-January. We got this email mid-May.
Didn't happen in mid-January.
Mid-June.
Mid-June.
Mid-June, not mid-January. We got this email in mid-May, about a month before. So by time this email gets to this writer, this problem has been solved, folks, because in mid-June, IRS came out. It's not a revenue ruling, they call it. It's like a clarification. I forget what they call it, but it was 2020-51, where they said, we're going to go back to January 1st, and we're going to give everyone who took an RMD this year till August 31st to get it back in.
Right.
So they just, was it August 15th they're given or August 31st?
I think it's the end of August, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's August 31st. So they just kind of cleared up the mess like Ed Slott thought they would. So this listener, folks, his dad's all set, and I'm sure this listener knows that, and as soon as 2020-51 came out last month, he probably took care of it for his dad. But I want to go back to his original email because he's getting a few things wrong, and I just want to add a little clarity. So back to his original email. His dad's second RMD, which was taken February 20th, no problem. He put that back within 60 days. And I would say shortly after his dad put it back, they probably came out with that ruling that gave his dad till July 15th anyways.
Yeah.
So that one was okay. But it's the first RMD, the 2019 one that he delayed to 2020, which surprised me that they are going to allow him to not take that, because that's 2019's RMD, folks. When you delay your first required minimum distribution, and that's the only one you're allowed to delay until April 1st of the year following the year you turn now 72, but at the time 70 and a half, only that RMD can be delayed, but it's not considered. In fact, you notice the account balance must have been different, Chris, because the two RMD amounts are totally different. That was a 2019 RMD, and you base it off of 2018's value.
Right.
Even though you're delaying it. So it's really weird that they're allowing that delayed RMD to also be put back, but they are. So his question was this. This is before 2020-51 came out and cleared the air. He tried to get creative, Chris, on putting back that 2019 RMD. Mm-hmm. And here's how he wanted to do it. So he writes, my question has to do with my dad's 2019 RMD. For clarification, the 2019 RMD check, and write these dates down, Chris, and follow his logic, and you can pick up where he made a mistake. He said the check was dated January 21st, 2020. My father received the check January 27th, 2020, but he did not cash the check until January 31st, 2020. And then he said, sometimes a little knowledge, Chris, can go in the wrong way. So he said, I researched and found an article fixing unwanted RMDs taken before the CARES Act waiver of 2020 by Michael Kitsis. Mm-hmm. We know Mike, mm-hmm. we talk about him with glowing admiration on the show. Mike is a very smart man. And in it, Mike writes, it's important to realize your 60-day rollover window does not begin until a taxpayer actually receives their distribution. And day one begins being counted the day after receipt. Mm-hmm. So he went and said...
Because he cashed it on January 31st,
yes,
he pushed it a day.
Yeah. He said, since my dad cashed the check on January 31st, and according to Michael Kitsis, the counting begins the next day, that gives us February 1st. So do you think we can put that RMD back? Now, before we explain to him where he went wrong on this, you follow what he's trying to do, listeners. He's trying to get to that magic, arbitrary February 1st date. His dad had a check written to him on January 21st, receives it 6 days later on January 27th, and cashes it 3 days later on 4 days later on January 31st. Then he thinks the 60-day clock begins February 1st, giving him that magical, my dad took his distribution on February 1st. Where's he going wrong, Chris?
Well, unfortunately, it's in the constructive receipt definition. His constructive receipt, according to him and his dates, is January 27th. So there's nothing going to buy him the time to make it effectively received on February 1st, because it's when you have that check in hand in your control. Just because you sit on it and don't cash it doesn't mean it wasn't received by you. Now, if we've talked about in the past on the show, if it came to your mailbox and you had one of these maybe neighborhood remote mailboxes and you just never got around to going and picking up your mail until February 2nd, that would be the constructive receipt date when you lay your hands on the check. And the crazy thing about this whole thing is that he's divulged when these dates are, but nobody's reporting these dates, and there's no way for the IRS to know these dates. So they would only know these based on what you tell them, which, you know, makes enforcement very difficult in this case. The good news is he's gotten the get out of jail free card with the revised IRS instructions and determinations that came out in mid-June. But this is one thing, this kind of gray area about when the 60-day clock starts is in play when there's a check written to you, when it's actually done as a rollover where a check is written to you rather than a electronic transfer, because then there's no question about constructive receipt. There's an electronic record of exactly when the money went into your account. Boom, it's yours. You have constructive receipt. There's no gray area there. But when they mail you a check, the travel time in the mail, whether you were able or not able or chose not to go pick it up out of the mailbox, all of that comes into play. And it's not tracked. It's not recorded. It's not out there for verification. So it's kind of a weird rule, kind of the soft underbelly of some of the tax code that in certain cases you could create, you know, the date that you want to start the 60-day rollover by delaying your constructive receipt by not going to take the check out of the mailbox.
Exactly. And he alludes to that because he continues. On your show, you and Chris always talk about constructive receipt, which is what you picked up on, Chris, and how it does not matter what date the check is. Now, let's pause there. He is 100% correct, folks. We've talked about that on the show. His check was dated. His dad's check was dated January 21st. That is not when the 60-day clock begins. Chris and I have talked about this repeatedly. It's not the day you call the custodian and ask for the check. It's not the day that the custodian cuts the check. It's not even the date the check ends up in your mailbox. It is technically the date, as Chris said, you touch the check. And by his own admission, that was January 27th, was when his dad touched the check. He was trying to key off of the day his dad cashed the check, Friday, January 31st. So he continues. It's my understanding, though, the IRS has no way to prove when my father actually took constructive receipt of the check. And that's what you just pointed out, Chris. The way this rule is written, it is that gray. You could have a check that was cut January 21st, and you don't actually receive it until December 21st. Now, you might think I'm being facetious. I've talked repeatedly on this show when I first moved to the little town of Berthoud 8 years ago, Berthoud, Colorado. I moved in September. I mailed my father his Christmas gift before Thanksgiving. And my dad received it the following April. He did.
I hope it wasn't perishable.
No, it wasn't, thankfully. It was a package. I can't remember what it was, but he received it in April. If that was a distribution check for a 60-day rollover, it would have began the 60 days in April when you receive it, not in November when you requested it. But the taxes would have been owed in November's tax return, not November's, but that year, I moved in 2012, you would have had to pay taxes on that money in 2012, not when you cashed it in 2013. And that has been held up in tax court repeatedly. It's when the money is distributed out, not when you actually cash the check. You owe the taxes. But the 60-day clock begins when you touch the check. My dad didn't touch his Christmas gift until the following April. So he was saying, Chris, his way around this was saying, what if my dad took receipt of the check on January 31st? So he's telling us the truth. My dad got it on the 27th. But what if we say he got it on the 31st and cashed it on the 31st? That's where his dad made one mistake in this, not knowingly. It wasn't done on purpose. If he waited one more day to cash the check, he'd have been all set. But his dad cashed it on the 31st, and the IRS can track it at that point. If they really wanted to in an audit, not that I don't think they ever would, they could have pulled bank records and saw when that check got deposited and cashed in, January 31st. So he was going to claim, Chris, that his dad received it on the 31st, and therefore the 60-day clock begins February 1st, allowing him time to put that check back in as well.
Yeah, but he's confusing the counting of the 60-day clock with the IRS rule that said it had to anything February 1st or after. So
exactly.
It wouldn't have worked anyway, even if he were to ignore the 27th of where he admitted that was truly constructive receipt and then claimed that it was the 31st, which he'd have to. He couldn't claim a date later than that because he deposited it that day. So it clearly had to have been constructively received by that day. That doesn't buy him that counting of the 60 days doesn't affect the fact that he received it on January 31st, which is how the rule was originally written, that the distribution had to be February 1st or after, and he would have missed it by a day still. He was well beyond the 60 days at that point too, because he wrote to us in mid-May, right? So even if started counting the 60 days, where he wouldn't have had to worry about any special rule that extended it, he was still within the 60-day period there. He's going to be, after the 60 days, at, what, April 1st, roughly, at that point? So he was writing to us in May, so he couldn't hang his hat even on a 60-day thing as far as timing goes. But, you know, good news is, after we've talked about this middle part, really to clarify constructive receipt and how that really works, the good news for him is in June, they gave him the free pass on this, and he's got until the end of August to get that money back in for his 29 delayed RMD. And at this point, then no worries. He doesn't have to try to do anything convoluted or gray area. He should be able to fix this legitimately and straight up.
Exactly. So that's Chris picked up on everything that I wanted to mention to this listener. His idea wouldn't have worked anyways, because the IRS would have simply said, you got that before our arbitrary February 1st date. We said any RMD February 1st or later. Constructive receipt is not the same thing as when the 60-day clock begins. They're very closely related. They're kissing cousins, but they're not the same thing. So anyways, the IRS gave him additional leeway, no problem. So he is good to go with that recent 2020-51 clarification. And hopefully this listener's dad got that money back in. If you didn't, listener, you have until the end of August to get that first distribution of $100,000 into his account again. Okay. Do we still have time for more?
Mm-hmm. You have time for one more.
Okay. This one is more of a planning one. We have a couple of, I term them planning questions, because they have to do more with retirement planning and planning in general than a specific question. This is a man who is going to ask us about Monte Carlo and our concept of fund spending. So it begins, hello team, you do a great job and really appreciate the podcast. I guess calling us team just clears the air, so you don't
covers
have to
everyone.
Say Pete,
yeah.
Bob, Jim, Chris,
Steve, all the people that get mentioned on here.
Exactly. Over the last few podcasts, you have done a good job on beating up on Monte Carlo. Now, let's pause there. Chris and I don't purposely try to beat up on Monte Carlo. We just don't believe in Monte Carlo as a way of doing retirement planning or retirement projections. It flies in the face of everything in the industry, practically, because the industry is predominated by investment advisors who also call themselves a financial planner, but at their heart, they're looking to gather assets called AUM, assets under management, manage money, charge some percentage to manage the money, and they're going to throw in retirement planning on top of that. So one way that they can build in for the uncertainty of investments is through a program, or it used to be a standalone program, but now it's built into everything. Would you call it a program now, Chris, or more of a
not really a program, as an approach or a statistical analysis?
Okay, so we'll call it statistical analysis. They call it Monte Carlo after the gambling that takes place in Monte Carlo, and all what it does is it builds in randomness into any type of withdrawal strategy from a portfolio.
Well, specifically, it builds in randomness to the returns, the annual returns on the portfolio.
Correct. But when you apply a withdrawal strategy to randomized returns, the portfolio could run out of money at different points.
Right.
And then if they run iterations, they call them, different iterations, and they'll run 500, 1,000, 10,000 iterations, and they draw lines on all those iterations. It looks like spaghetti. It calls a spaghetti chart. And then they highlight the average of them all and come up and say, this is your chance or what you will likely occur with these 10,000 different randomized iterations. Did I explain that reasonably accurately?
Yeah, maybe to make it a little more basic for people. Essentially, they take a computer program, and since you only get to experience your life once, which means you're going to experience one series of annual returns on your portfolio assets. What they are going to do is essentially pretend like you lived your retirement years 500 times or 1,000 times or 10,000 times, each time applying a random sequence of returns every year to show how the portfolio will be sustained or maybe run out out of however, you know, if they run it 10,000 times, they'll look at how many times does it run out before someone reaches the age of 90, 95, 100, whatever number that they're using. You can set all these variables in there, and then they come back and tell you, for instance, if of those 10,000 hypothetical lives that they simulated in this program run, if 5% of the time you run out of money before you reach your, you know, the mortality age that they set, say 95, they'll come back and tell you they've got a 95% confidence that your retirement will be successful. That's how they essentially talk about this. They're admitting that 5% of the time in our projections, or if you were to have a time machine and relive these your retirement years over and over and over and over again, about 5% of the time you run out of money before you get to 95. But we feel pretty good about it because 95% of the time, you don't run out of money. That's essentially kind of what they're doing with these iterations and with this computer programming and running this kind of analysis.
Exactly. So he continues because he kind of picks up on what we've alluded to on the show and that I've blatantly said in the past, that Monte Carlo has come out and is a way to get investment advisors to allow you to keep your money with them when you retire, and paying them to manage it because you need their level of expertise in order to manage the return expectations and get that probability of 80, 85, 90% success. Chris and I disagree with that type of retirement planning ad nauseum, and that's not really where we're going with this question. But he begins, I agree with you on how many advisors use Monte Carlo and that it is of very low value. Many of them only use it before you retire to show you if you are way off course from your expectations. But really, though, I think most seem to use it just to show you they want you to keep working with them and putting away more money with them. Mm-hmm. So he's a little cynical, too, on Monte Carlo. But he continues. But if you have set up your minimum dignity floor and roughed out the fund spending you want to do during your go-go, slow-go, and no-go years, then what do you think about once a year just running Monte Carlo to see how things are holding up? Such as, does the plan need to be modified, and maybe I need to spend a little bit more on fun, or maybe a little bit less on fun? In this case, it does not have to be 100% guaranteed, but just some comfortable percentage on how long my fund money will last. And I don't quite understand his last sentence. More, can I continue to spend my yearly allocated fund money, or should I tweak it up or down a little in the coming years? I don't quite know what he means by that, but I think what he's asking, Chris, is what do you think of running a Monte Carlo on his fun spending to see if he can spend a little bit more on fun or a little bit less? Before you opine, mm-hmm. I just want to say I think the guy is overanalyzing and misses the boat on what I personally want you to do with your fun money. So I'm going to answer it from that approach, and I'm going to let you answer the question in any way you want. It's the first time you've seen this question. And in fact, it came in almost 3 months ago on the end of April, April 30th. My thoughts are, folks, once you take care of your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, once you build in and address what you're going to do about aging assistance, not only with your inability to take care of that lifestyle that you just protected, that lifestyle of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, what if as you age, you need to bring people in to take care of the lifestyle, but also you take care of, or at least put a plan in place to bring people in to take care of yourself if you can't? So in other words, an aging assistant. And once you address a guaranteed inheritance, if that's important to you or not, some people it is, some people it's not. And once you build in a buffer, as Chris and I always say, build in some extra money for the older you in case something goes wrong. So your food is taken care of. Your utilities, transportation, housing, and health care are all taken care of with lifetime guaranteed income that you cannot outlive. Your aging assistance has been taken care of either through self-funding some of it with some of your assets and removing that assets from your fund money, or by leveraging it in some type of long-term care insurance policy or a mixture of both of them. Once your guaranteed inheritance is set, and that can be done the same way through a guaranteed account you put off to the side and you fund with money, and that money is not part of your fund money anymore. It's being earmarked towards a inheritance, or you leverage it with some type of guaranteed life insurance policy to make sure money is paid out to whoever you're trying to guarantee an inheritance for. Once that is done, and then you take the rest of your assets and say, I'm going to put another 10% of it aside as a buffer. So if you had $1.5 million still left over after doing everything we just said, you're going to put another $150,000 off to the side from your $1.5 million. And now you've got $1.35 million that's earmarked for fun. I want you to stop looking at that $1.35 million and saying, that's my investment. You're to start looking at that and saying, that's my deferred spending. And it doesn't matter, listener, running Monte Carlo on that, wondering how long it's going to last. I want you to die with nothing in that $1.35 million. You'll still have your money in the buffer. You'll still have your guaranteed inheritance. You'll have whatever money you put aside for aging assistance, and any money you put aside for your minimum dignity floor as you waited to reach certain ages to purchase additional lifetime income annuities, you're still going to have all that money. But that money that you want to spend on fun, in my quick example, that $1.35 million, you don't have to run Monte Carlo on that and overcomplicate this and wonder if you could be spending a little more or if you should cut your spending. You should never cut your fund spending, because at any point in time, you're not going to be able to do fun things. And I can tell you countless stories of a very good client of mine last year who died unexpectedly at age 73. Other clients of mine who have retired in their 60s and been handed horrendous medical diagnoses that are going to cut short one or both spouses' life expectancies. And their fund spending is now out the window, because sooner or later, something's going to happen to you and you can't spend on fun. I don't want you to curtail fund spending because the market is down. If that $1.35 million is your deferred fund spending, it doesn't matter what you earn on it. Not literally, but you could put it all in cash and just let it sit there and spend it down over the rest of your life. That's your fun budget. Or you could invest it, but who gives a damn if it, oh gosh, my fun pool dropped a little. I've got to cut my spending. We're not going to go on this around the world cruise bucket list item that I always wanted to do. Under what, listener? Waiting until you get a better Monte Carlo projection of that fun money? And you're going to run the risk that at any time you can get that same medical diagnosis and your ability to do fun is over? To me, once you can come up and protect all the other items that I mentioned, you will spend that fun money as fast or as slow as you want. And you don't really have to try to do all this projections and overcomplicate it. It's your fun money. Go out and spend it. It's like your grandmother who gave you $100 on your birthday. And she would just tell you, go out and spend it. Have fun. Do something. Just go do it. Now, granted, if you want it to last well into your 80s and 90s, you might want to take some of that $1.35 million and put it off to the side and say, it's earmarked for fun, but I'm not going to spend it. And that's where Chris and I borrowed the go-go, slow-go, no-go concept. How much of that $1.35 million do you want to spend in your go-go years, those first 8-10 years of retirement, when you still have the health inclination and desire to do fun? Well, you might want to spend 60-70% of the $1.35 million during that phase. So to me, that money should just be in cash or cash-like holdings, not literally cash, it doesn't pay much, but cash-like holdings that might pay 1 or 2 or 3%. And then the other monies for the slow-go and no-go phase, you can invest those if you'd like. But to me, it's deferred spending, and it needs to be positioned to be spent. And you don't have to apply Monte Carlo to it at all. That's my take. What is your take, Chris?
My initial take is that it's a bit more attractive than doing Monte Carlo to the overall situation. So we've talked a ton about how if you set things up the way we're talking, Monte Carlo isn't particularly beneficial, because the big scare with Monte Carlo is the what happens in the 5% where I run out of money. Yes, you're telling me I'm 95% confident I shouldn't, but what happens in the other five? And the other five, if it's devastating, is very scary. If you take our approach, you've positioned or set up a platform or foundation of coverage of your minimum dignity floor. So if you run out of other assets, it isn't as devastating. It isn't particularly devastating in that particular case. So that changes the dynamics. What he's talking about doing is segregating just his fun budget and the money earmarked for fun, and almost treating it like its own little case, its own little scenario off to the side. And I agree that doesn't, because we're not trying to build a foundation and we're just looking at, you know, what are the chances under my current spending behavior that, you know, if we run 10,000 hypothetical lives here, how often at this current spending behavior does it look like I would run out of money or make it to the end? And while that's a bit more valuable, I still think it fails fundamentally for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think if you, from year to year, let's say you go 1 year and the next year you run a new Monte Carlo and it looks a little bit worse. The worst thing in the world is to suddenly cut back your spending as a reaction to that, because that might be a 1 year anomaly and next year things are better than it was and now you're on a track a little bit above. So now you're reacting like a whip, you know, you're got whiplash going back and forth year to year. In changing your spending behavior. And the whole point, like Jim and I talk about all the time, is to spend it while you're young enough. Don't be curtailing it and missing out because you get some kind of signal from an analysis like Monte Carlo. You may not have next year to wait, or the year after, or the year after that. So reacting to it then in that way, I think, would be bad. The other thing you're going to find is, because we're talking about randomized sequence of returns here over maybe a 30-year period, a typical length of a retirement, if you look at it, say you did this 1 year and then the next year you look at it again, the results actually aren't going to change that much, because only one of those 30 years has really been set in stone now. The other 29 are still randomized, and there's no reason why 29 randomized returns with 10,000 iterations is going to end up being much different than 30 of them. So early on, when you'd like to have the best information, you're actually not getting a whole lot of new information that would be valuable at that time. When it's going to start to make more and more of a difference is towards the end, where hopefully you've spent through most of your money when you're older, in your 80s and 90s, and there's just not that much fun budget left because you enjoyed your 60s and 70s while you were young and healthy enough to do so. So it's a little less bad, I'd say, than the way we describe the overall approach of using Monte Carlo as the determinant on how much you should spend or budget for your overall retirement spending, which we've talked a bunch about how we don't like that. Segregating it just to fund spending behavior is less troublesome in my mind, but still misses the mark for, I think, the way people should behave. I think you're overcomplicating it, like Jim said. I think you'll get a feel for how things are going. You'll know how your portfolio, you kind of imagine the trajectory based on your spending. And if the trajectory starts turning out worse than normal, if you want to curtail your spending because it makes you feel better, you could. But if you've positioned things properly, you shouldn't have to do that. You shouldn't have to do that because the consequences of running out a little bit short or running out a little bit early are not particularly consequential. It's not jeopardizing all the things that you find most important. Those have all been handled in another way. This is just fun spending. So if you end up having to cut back, you know, a couple years towards the end, I agree with what Jim said, set aside money for the slow go, no go period and truly drill down to not only is this my fun number budget, it's my fun number budget just during my go, go period, which you can define yourself. Maybe it's up to age 75. Worst case scenario, you run a little short in, 72, 73, as you approach that 75. And maybe the money you set aside for your slow go, no go has grown more than you expected, and that could be offset or it's less than you expected. But again, it's just fun, which is purely discretionary. And those choice, prime, early years of your go, go period, you spent while you enjoyed it, while you could enjoy it, while you could create memories, do things with your family, not being slave to the gyrations of the market and some signaling that you might get from year-to-year fluctuations in a Monte Carlo analysis. So not a big fan still, slightly more of a fan than the overall Monte Carlo approach, but still I think it goes against the way to most optimally enjoy your retirement.
Yeah, and I just want to close because I know we're going to wrap up the show with two thoughts for this listener and all our listeners. This person is still thinking like an accumulation do-it-yourselfer and not a distribution do-it-yourselfer. He's still trying to use accumulation rules in a distribution portfolio. I would encourage him to not do that. And I would encourage everyone, as Chris also said, to try to do your fund spending. I would rather you, rather than cutting your initial fund spending, Chris, and sacrifice your ability to do something because the markets have roiled your fund money, that means you didn't position it well. Mm-hmm. We've always said on this show, you should position the spending you want to do, at least the spending for the first 3, 5, 8 years of your retirement, very safe. So come hella high water, you're doing what you want to do. I don't want you to cut that fund spending. I want you to spend there. And if you cut any fund spending, let the 80 or 85 year old you cut some fund spending.
Yeah, amen.
Because the 80, 85-year-old, you might not be able to do it, but at the very least, they would appreciate the memories of what you did as a 60 or 65-year-old you, where you may not feel young at 60 or 65, but compared to the 80, 85-year-old you, you're a spring chicken.
Yep.
And the 80, 85-year-old you might say, you know what? Yeah, I'm only going to go out to eat 4 days a week, not 7. I'm going to cut a little, but my God, that cruise I did when I was 68, oh Lord, that was fun. That's the way we want you to look at it. When we say money left over is life unlived, and I said that once, and I jokingly on the podcast, if you remember, Chris said the last check you write should be to the undertaker and it should bounce. I was being facetious. If that was your whole portfolio, someone took me literally on that, and I don't blame them. I probably sounded literal when I said it. We would never advocate you spend all your money and you die a pauper. That's why we have all these protections built in. A buffer, a guaranteed inheritance, aging assistance, and minimum dignity floor. Don't lose sight of that, folks. Under Chris and I's philosophy and approach, those four items are all taken care of. Some people, Chris, say my answer to this is I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to leave a guaranteed inheritance, or I'm not going to do an aging assistance, or I'm not going to put a buffer in. Some people's answer is they don't do it. That's very few. Most people will protect all four of those to whatever degree is important to them. And then whatever's left over, folks, is fun. And it's that money I want you to die without. and not because Wall Street took it. That's just asinine to even risk your deferred spending. I would put it very safe. My deferred spending when I retire is going to be uber safe. Why? Because I want to enjoy it. It's not going to buy me a better seat on the right hand of God. I don't want to die with any fun money, but I don't want to die a pauper. I want to make sure that the older me is taken care of with aging assistance. I don't have a guaranteed inheritance because I don't have children, so I have no guaranteed inheritance in my retirement plan. And I do have a buffer. I want to make sure my buffer, my aging assistance, and my minimum dignity floor are protected. So I will die with money. But the money that I have, Chris, in my fun pool, I don't want any in that. And that's what we're trying to get you to understand. Stop thinking you got to make that fun pool last forever. Break it out ahead of time. Get the go-go money. Put that very safe and go have fun and stop worrying about Monte Carlo. That's what I would say.
Yep. Okay.
All right.
Perfect. Well,
I will chat with everyone later. I'll let Chris wrap this up. I've got to log on, Chris, to my CE course that begins in 20 minutes.
Perfect.
So I will chat with everyone later. Chris, stay healthy. Don't go into the basement. That's like a horror movie. Stay out of the basement.
I know. Oh, I am. Believe me. I don't even like walking past the door to the basement. So.
Do you guys have that, you know, like those little beanbag-filled worms that go under the door to stop a breeze? Do you have that under the basement door?
Actually, the way our HVAC works, the airflow sucks into the basement from the main floor. There's a net air down, so which is good. It's actually sucking air into the basement rather than pushing it out.
Okay,
so,
that was going to be my next question.
Yeah,
what
no,
are you doing
so I, yeah, no, I looked at that. If it was blowing air out from the basement, we would have been plugging that thing up.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, listeners. Hopefully you found these four questions good. Chris will explain to you how to get us questions or to work with us if you'd like to. Other than that, I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay, have a good afternoon. Well, thanks, everybody, for sticking with us on another Q&A show. If you'd like to send in your own questions, the best way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Technically, chrishelps.com gets there, but as Jim always points out, the word Jim has fewer letters than Chris, so it's a shorter address. But either one will get you to our main website there where you can learn a little bit more about us. There's a contact form on there. You can submit your questions right through there. Don't have to necessarily be questions you want for the show. If you have other generalized questions, you can shoot them right through the contact form there. A good description of kind of our philosophy and what we do, our backgrounds right on that website. And while we aren't currently taking new retirement planning clients at this point, we are getting all of our resources in place so that we can start doing that again, most likely this fall sometime. So that would also be the website where you'd go to inquire about having us do some retirement planning for you if that's something that you're interested in. I think that's about all I need to say. So everyone stay safe, stay healthy out there. I'll try to do the same on my end so we can keep doing the podcast and keep producing retirement plans for those people that we have on board already. But we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.